Ahoy, ahoy, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Talk to the Audience. I am your host, Bob Mackey, and with me, as always, is...
The very harried from moving, Henry Gilbert.
Yes.
Hi.
We're recording in a new space, so if things sound a little off, we will fix it for the next recording. But we listened to a playback, and I think it sounds okay.
Sounds all right. Yeah.
We're still in a cavernous living room, so we recorded in a much smaller space before.
Yeah, I know. We just moved into my new apartment, which me and my significant other, we moved into a one-bedroom from my very small and cramped studio.
Is this how you're spending your Patreon money, Henry? This is irresponsible.
Yes.
Should be living in a box.
To pay $200 more a month on rent. I can finally afford it.
It's really nice. You're helping Henry move on up. To the same part of town.
Yeah, no, I just moved 3 blocks away. I was worried a couple times when I tweeted, I'm moving. And people thought, is this the end of the Patreon? I was worried it would scare some folks.
I had to reassure a few people, but I don't think it was a massive freak out. But yeah, we were late with this episode because of Thanksgiving and Henry doing the whole moving process, which if you've been through it before, and I assume most of our listeners have, it's just the biggest nightmare. I think on the rank of the most stressful things that happen in your life, it's like a significant other dying. Dying, parent dying, and then moving.
Yes.
And then losing a job. Moving is in the top three, I know that much.
Yeah, no, it was the most stressful thing I think I've ever gone through. I was shaking with stress. And then eventually by the end of it, I was I should have just realized I was going to pay cleaners to just clean out all this stuff and not even have to worry. So I actually went 10 days without seeing Bob, which is pretty crazy.
That is pretty crazy.
It was so weird to finally see you again. Hey, Bob, it feels like forever because we usually see each other at least once every 48 hours or 72 hours.
For 6 months, we saw each other practically every day.
Pretty much.
At the same job.
Yeah. So... but yeah, Thanksgiving went good. It was also the first time my mom had met my boyfriend, which was nice. And
I'm glad it went well.
That was the beginning of the stress sandwich I ate for basically 10 days straight. And also, having somebody clean out my apartment of all the junk and just have to tell them, look, I don't care about that. The GameCube's got to go. Just throw it out. I can't keep this shit anymore.
I think you posted the GIF of Lenny in his
shack.
Don't tell anyone how I live.
Well, I always felt that way. You were one of the rare friends who got to see my apartment much because I just felt so much shame over just how cluttered it was, but I just couldn't get rid of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, so now we're back on track with Talking Simpsons, though, and we didn't miss any dates. We recorded... Though I will say there's an episode this week that this week's episode on the Patreon, 2001 Greyhounds, we talked for, I think, 4 minutes on the Today Show. Thankfully, we never mentioned Matt Lauer by name.
I forgot that happened in the wake of... Okay, yeah.
It's been 3 weeks since we recorded it, and since then, Matt Lauer has been revealed to be the sex dungeon monster.
He had a Mr. Burns button on his desk.
Yeah, that's scary.
It's not cool to joke about sexual harassment or assault, but I was mad that someone beat me to the Mr. Burns button joke on Twitter.
The very funny Nick Weiger I saw, he said that you know that Mr. Burns was evil because he had a button like that.
And then I had another thought that Austin Walker, games journalist, had. I was somebody had to install that. There was a work order put in for the sex button.
Yeah.
And an electrician had to be hey, Mr. Lauer, I've installed your sex button today. So
that reminds me, on 30 Rock, they had a joke about Brian Williams and what a weirdo he was, that he became this kind of weirdo guy. And there's a joke that Ken the Page had to install a glass toilet for him.
Oh.
And I wonder now if those jokes were really about these weird sex demands of Matt Lauer.
You know what? You're probably right. It's just a way to get out that anger safely.
They do it about their friend Brian Williams when they're really talking about Matt Lauer. So, yes, if you listen to 2001 Greyhounds and you're like, why don't you guys talk about Matt Lauer when talking about the Today Show for 5 minutes? It's because we recorded beforehand. There's literally no way to predict who else will be revealed as a sex pervert.
Every morning I click the moments tab on Twitter and I'm who's next? Who's next?
Right now, Brian Singer is I'm sick.
Yes.
He's got
very ill. So there's one more delay I want to talk about. So this episode was delayed. There will not be a talking critic this Friday because Michael and Diana were traveling and also the holiday happened. So we're sorry about that, but we will be back on schedule the next week, which will I think will be the second to last episode.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're recording Ducarella. And we'll be doing the final episode and the webisodes as one talking critic, because the final episode is a terrible clip show.
Awful.
And the webisodes are probably worse than that.
Yes. So apologies, no critic this week. But we're also thinking about what will replace the critic.
Right.
And that time to come. And you might see a post on that soon. And maybe you'll get to be involved in that.
I don't know how much we will want to give away here. And I can always edit this out. But I think the plan is, if we're going to be doing a long running series, to just do one season for now. So that way, if you're not the biggest fan of whatever we do next, we won't lose you and we won't be attached to one thing for the next 4 or 5 years.
Not committing immediately to 130 episodes of, say, Futurama
or whatever.
From the beginning, or set 250 of King of the Hill.
Right, yeah. I mean, as much as I would love to do that, I don't want to alienate patrons, and I like variety. And we haven't unlocked that animation series yet.
Yeah.
So this is a way for us to also jump around and do different things.
Mm-hmm. Jump around, get up, and get down, as they say.
But we have some big stuff planned. We're talking to some, like, I consider, like, Bill Oakley caliber guests
for our
podcast.
I don't want to, you know, cancellations can happen, all that, so I don't want to get you guys too excited. But yes, at least two biggies I have in the hopper right now. I'm hoping that we'll come together.
Yes, it's going to be amazing, and I can't wait to talk to these people. Oh, boy, it's going to be great. So anything else we have to talk about?
No, not really, other than getting into the comments. I think Simpsons news, there hasn't been a ton of Simpsons news in the last month related to the show beyond the big one that we did a whole podcast about. Though I did watch the episode where Marge became mayor, because it started with the monorail being brought back up. And my only issue with it was that, like, they didn't fix it, that Marge wasn't mayor at the end. But and I hear, though, they did another future forward episode this week.
Just a few days ago. Yeah. I haven't had a chance to check it out yet, but I believe it references Lisa's wedding. I should have came prepared for this, but maybe next time we'll talk about
it. Yes, we will be doing another talk to the audience this month, though, because this is the makeup for the November one, but we're going to do another December one, too.
We don't want to leave you hanging. So should we get to the problem with Apu comments?
Yes.
Well, the first thing I want to say is we have amazing patrons. There was no awful comments on this, and I was worried there would be. A few people weren't totally on board, but I feel like they were polite and they argued their points well, and I think ultimately we came to find common ground on this thing.
Yeah, I think so too. We weren't called SJWs or monsters for trying to destroy the show or whatever with this. So yeah, and it was the start of a conversation type thing. This was one bit of news that I wanted to read off. Hank Azaria got cornered by TMZ, or it was just one of those many TMZ videos where, like, some person sees him in public, they're like, and they have their cell phone out, they're like, hey, what do you think of this thing in the news? And then they just make a statement and then they send it to TMZ. So this was Hank Azaria gave a comment on the documentary Now, which the entire documentary is about getting a comment from Hank Azaria, really getting an interview, which he does not grant. But so he said, quote, I think the documentary made some really interesting points and gave us a lot to think about, and we really are thinking about it. Definitely anybody who is hurt or offended by it or by the character and vocal performance, it's really upsetting that it was offensive or hurtful to anybody. Then he continued, I think it's an important conversation worth having. And as for the future of Apu, he says, we're still thinking about it. It's a lot to digest. And I saw the Hari Kondabolu, he commented on it more too, of just like, don't kill Apu. Don't make him go away. Like, you can't do that either. It's just like, so the only Indian on the show, now he's just dead.
I think he said that in the documentary, too. And one thing I noticed is that Hari was favoriting tweets about our podcast. So I don't expect him to give us money to hear it. I think I just want to send it to him or find a way to give him that that podcast we did about his work, just so he knows what we think about it. Not all Simpsons fans are reactionary jerks who hate him immediately. So I feel like we gave him more of a chance than most people.
Yeah, I think he probably is used to the big time fans going like, why are you trying to destroy my favorite show? Which is not his intention. And I feel like in the film, he makes a very good case of, I like the show too, guys. But all right, let's read some of the comments that we got from our wonderful listeners. So I'll go first with John Colbert. said, growing up in Northern Ontario, I have never even met an East Indian until I was an adult, and only a few black people, for that matter. And adults around me were casually racist, so I guess count me as one who had this all fly right over his head, too. But it's interesting to think the early Apu really was a complete racist stereotype. I'm not going to lie, one that got laughs, but a stereotype nonetheless. And yet, there weren't many other ethnic stereotypes on the show that I can think of off the top of my head that were negatively racist.
Yeah, once again, I feel that is Matt Groening's impact on the show. Pooh just kind of slipped through. There weren't a lot of racial humor involving black people, Asian people. I guess there was at some point, and Matt, you know, stamped that out after the sushi episode, I believe.
Yeah, sometimes you see jokes. I said it on many Talking Critics where you'd see a joke, and I said, Matt Groening wouldn't have let them do that joke, but he's not there on the critic.
So Silent Man says, this got me thinking about the other reoccurring racial minority characters in the show and how they compare to Apu and the Italians. For black characters, I could only think of Carl and Dr. Hibbert. They're mostly racism-free, just an average working-class guy and the most competent doctor in the city, but they're played by Hank Azaria and Harry Shearer, respectively, both white guys. For East Asian characters, I can only think of Cookie Kwan, a complete non-character whose only joke is that she cares a lot about the realty market on the West Side and has an accent. She is played by a white woman, Tress MacNeille. Yeah, I mean, there are no, outside of, what's the one black writer who a few times has done black characters
on the Michael show? Carrington.
Michael Carrington has done it a few times, but for the most part, this is an all-white cast. And I even commented on this on the Patreon that the only racial joke I can think of with Dr. Hibbert is the fact that he has different black, trendy black hairstyles in the flashbacks. But even that, I don't think is insulting. It's just like he would have these hairstyles, like Homer's hair would be of the 70s or whatever.
And the only times I can recall them making like jokes about Carl's ethnicity were just in contrast to Lenny, of just saying, Homer saying, you ever notice the white guys are named Lenny and black guys are named Carl?
Or he has a Lenny White, Carl Black written on his hand,
But not so, but I think there might be other ones where they've gone into it. And then meanwhile, you have characters like Cookie Kwan is absolutely like, she is a total stereotype.
She's a real tiger mom style.
Absolutely. Yeah. She is the hyper driven Asian American woman stereotype who takes all business seriously and then just screams at people all the time. Like,
but even that is a somewhat observational characteristic. Like we see in King of the Hill, Khan and his wife have to be more competitive because they are immigrants in America. Mm-hmm. And that explains sort of that kind of behavior. But ultimately it is Tress MacNeille putting on an accent at the end of the day.
It's not great. Not great. Tashlin says, I was hoping you guys were going to cover this and I love the episode. Since I know both of you are OKKO fans, I was reminded of the recent episode where KO found out that the trading cards he uses to keep track of his favorite heroes don't allow the species his friend Dende is to get their own cards. And the two of them were originally decide the only response is to throw their cards into the volcano before deciding that rather than discarding something they love, it is clearly problematic, they can go to the factory that makes them and make the people in charge add his friend's species to the pack. Dealing with /improving/questioning something you love that you know is behind the times is really difficult, especially with a 30-year institution like The Simpsons with such an insular staff for so many years. I do hope that docs like this and the continued diversity increase in the media landscape improves things and puts pressure on those to enact change, even if right now these South Asian entertainers, like the many minorities and just women in general, like Aziz Ansari, Mindy Kaling, and Kumail Nanjiani, the only way to get something made where the lead character looks like you and can be a nuanced portrayal is if you make it yourself. We may sadly have a while to go before a room of white guys won't see that as a risk. Yeah, first off, on the OKKO thing, that was one of my favorite questions we asked Ian Jones-Quartey in our interview.
Yeah, I thought we talked to him about that.
Yeah, and the episode is called No More POW Cards, if you want to look it up. And Ian Jones-Quartey makes a great comparison of that he, as a kid, loves old Warner animation and also knows that the Looney Tunes are full of problematic things, to say the least. And that especially for him, one of his favorites as an animation fan is the cartoon Coal Black and the Seven Dwarves, which is deeply offensive and hurtful, especially to an African-American like himself. And so he has to deal with that kind of stuff. And that episode is a bit about him working through that. And I think, too, the issue that they're going to have is you end up with this bypass of like, they have the writer's room, which is just insular in and of itself. It's not inherently racist, but it is friends hiring friends in a lot of cases. And that's just how these creative things work. And so they, if even if you're not a racist person, if you don't know a lot of people who aren't white, then you're not going to hire them because you're not their friends or you're not used to working with them, mm-hmm. or whatever. So it just, it's this feeding insularity that isn't intentionally exclusionary, perhaps, though yeah. in Sam Simon was intentionally exclusionary.
Thankfully, I think the 2010s has been a real movement for South Asian entertainers, because it's only in this decade have we seen these things like the Mindy Project. Mm-hmm. What's the Aziz Ansari series?
The Master of None.
That, and also
Kumail Nanjiani just put out the film The Big Sick.
That too, and this documentary you watch, I don't think these people would have opportunities even 10 years earlier.
No, I don't think so either. So yeah, and I think that's something too that helps that entertainment has become so much, the monoculture is dead, and so that allows a lot more like specialized entertainment, which lets more people have more opportunities too. They're making yeah. a lot more TV shows than ever, and so they maybe need people who aren't white to make them.
And speaking of Aziz, I think the character Tom Haverford on Parks and Rec was a big, huge moment for South Asian mm-hmm. Entertainers, because again, that is the creator of King of the Hill, the co-creator, casting a non-white person and looking at things mm-hmm. through a non-white person's eyes. But he acts very white, which is kind of the joke.
Yes, yeah. Now, I know Amy Poehler and Mike Schur as well. She talked a ton in her book about working hard to defy stereotypes with pretty much every character they got on the show, which I liked a lot. Mm-hmm.
So J.R. Rawls wants to know, does the documentary ever get into the demographic changes that America has undergone over the last 27 years? When Apu premiered in 1980, he was a character who was, what, 30 years old? So born in 1960, the number of U.S.-born citizens of Southeast Asian descent in 1960 was tiny. You could have probably fit them all in a building, and it wouldn't have had to be a very large building. But after the 1965 change in immigration, the U.S. got a large influx of Southeast Asian immigrants. But a generation takes a generation to raise, so it was overwhelmingly likely that a person of Indian descent in his late 20s and above in 1990 in America was not native-born. By contrast, that's not true in 2017, as the U.S. has an exponentially larger second-generation Southeast Asian American community than it did a generation ago.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting point, that that it also makes Apu kind of an aged character, and that like
right.
there in 1990 when he first appeared, there weren't a ton of second generation adult Indian American immigrants, thanks to just the change in immigration at the time.
Right, and I think that really explains characters like Apu and the guy in Short Circuit, in that the only place you would see, there was such a limited population of these immigrants in America, that the only place you would see them would be like the convenience store or an engineer. There weren't as many of these kind of people like living amongst you in your everyday life. And I feel like getting to be around other people is what breaks these stereotypes down.
I think, especially when they talk about the accent stuff in the documentary, I think for a lot of people it was just a shock to hear like, well, wait, you speak with an American accent? You're yeah. supposed to sound this way. This is my assumption. It's when assumptions hits ideas. And I think, too, that's maybe another thing that makes him such a dated character, perhaps, that he is close to 30 years old at this point, Apu yeah. is. So, yeah. And he's a tricky guy. And though that's also what happens when a show goes on too long, that all these things, it's same with like, if Home Improvement was still on today, somehow, and with all the actors in place, like people would say, the show Tool Time doesn't exist anymore. Why would this be his job? There's no shows like this on TV.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, it's fortunate for us that it's a cartoon, but that means almost everything is frozen in time mm-hmm. from when it started. So yeah, things age poorly in some cases.
All right, but let's get to the homie the clown comments here. Zachary Adams says, I'm a few years older than Chris, let alone Bob and Henry, and so I remember regional bozos and how the advent of WGN Chicago as a national superstation pretty much killed the racket. Bozo aired on Saturdays on Little Rock ABC. Wow, that's where I watched it too. And it was a cheap local show with a heavily accented bozo who did maybe 10 minutes of talking to kids in between Popeye shorts. Then suddenly we could see the real Bozo, and nobody gave a damn about this redneck. My girlfriend is my age but grew up without cable, and revisiting this ended up with a conversation about what superstations were and how they started and why they ended.
I had no exposure to Bozo. That's a very hard sentence to say. I just edited out me trying to say that three times. Exposure to Bozo. But I was aware of Bozo as a famous clown, but I had a similar cartoon host, but it was just a pleasant young woman in a sweater in front of a green screen giving away Tiny Toons posters or whatever. I mean, that's the closest I came to it. I don't know if these local hosts still exist. I assume they were all wiped out by Clear Channel in a mass extinction.
I remember very briefly seeing the regional Bozo in Arkansas that I think this guy is talking about as well, but it must have been right before his retirement because, yeah, WGN Bozo was just the Bozo.
If you listen to one of the commentaries, you will learn to hear how Al Jean was sat on by a local Bozo and he cried. Okay, so Daniel Fight says, whenever I accomplish some small feat and I score a compliment, I always reply with Homer's, well, it was my major, and nobody ever gets it. And I agree. I'm seeing double, full Krusties. It's a perfect joke because decades of media prior to that, including news broadcasts, used seeing double so casually that to actually make a character say I'm seeing double and then demonstrate that no, he really is seeing double is the ultimate payoff. And yes, Daniel, I agree with you. That is up there with Bort as like a mega clever... It's so understated you don't know how clever it is until you start taking it apart, and then it becomes boring because dissecting jokes is kind of sad and lonely. But I love the seeing double joke so much.
Ah, God, just his rubbing his eyes. I'm seeing double. It's like, you need to go to the doctor, legs.
There's a whole story with legs we need to find out about.
Andrew Bouvier says, great episode, guys. Sorry for the long comment, but I found it interesting that Chris, Bob, and Henry, mostly Chris, talked about billboards for a bit and sort of being a little excited like Homer when new ones came to town. I never experienced anything like this as a kid because I grew up and still live in Vermont. Thanks to a law passed in the 60s, Vermont has no billboards. Not just billboards, but overly large and or tall signs for businesses are prohibited as well. I remember the first time I was really exposed to them on a road trip we took to Disney World when I was 9 or 10. Driving down I-95 on the East Coast gives kids a lifetime's of exposure worth in just a couple days, and I do remember legitimately getting excited for some of the things I saw on them, most notably a truly massive amount of amusement park, restaurant, techie gift shops in South Carolina called South of the Border, which we also talked about in Barfers Australia, because it's over the border from North Carolina, which came complete with the Mexican Bandito mascot, which is just as racist as you'd imagine it. Even as a kid, I could appreciate how nice it is to drive somewhere and not have to deal with these eyesores. And as an added bonus, there's nothing for a cop to hide behind to catch you speeding.
Yeah, actually, on the Laser Time Facebook group, somebody posted the South of the Border gift shop photos of it. This was probably a month or so ago. I don't know how to find old posts on Facebook. I think it's impossible, but thank you to whoever did that because it was like, oh yeah, this is what they're referencing. But I lived in for a brief period of time when I worked at the video game company Atlas. I lived in Costa Mesa, but Atlas was in Irvine, and Irvine, California is a corporate-run city, which is terrifying. And one of the mandates is no billboards. So the highway I took there had no billboards on it. I didn't notice until someone told me, and then it felt kind of creepy. Like, oh, this is weird. Just these bare white corridors.
I wonder if those corporations are like, well, if we had billboards, then somebody could rent an anti-billboard and make fun of us or something. I wonder.
My neighbor, Guillermo del Totoro, says, this is one of my favorite episodes, if not the favorite. Fun fact, Joe Montana went to the same high school as me in the Chicagoland area. When he visited roughly 10 years ago, he made an anecdote regarding a bald female singer, so there's your clue. The whole theater department got to say hello and ask him questions. I got him to sign my arm, and a friend one-upped me and got his hairy chest signed. On the clown side of this episode, there's just so much to glean. I have an absolute love for clowns, so Krusty is probably my favorite clown. In fact, any Krusty episode until his daughter shows up is great. Oh, and if you didn't notice, I'm from Chicago, and Bozo showing up on WGN is something I remembered, at least reruns of it in the 90s. One more random tidbit, WGN is short for World's Greatest News. I say there should be a contest or a vote. They can't decide that on their own.
That's like Blue Ribbon, like Pops Blue Ribbon.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, they won a Blue Ribbon at the, I believe it was the first World's Fair, or it was the World's Fair that the book Devil in the White City is about. It's that's a great book about the first World's Fair and also a serial killer killing people at the fair.
Wow.
But it's about 800 pages. It's worth it. But I'm confused by this. Joe Mantegna went to his high school 10 years ago, and he gave an anecdote about, I'm guessing, Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah.
Wait, no, no. Like... It's probably Britney Spears.
Oh, yes. Okay. There's that's more than one.
Yeah,
yes.
She shaved her head for reasons. I don't know why.
I completely forgot about that.
It's in the trailer to Meet the Spartans.
Well, I've watched Meet the Spartans. It's one of the worst things I've ever seen. And but watching it also knowing like the other films by these guys are way worse, it's depressing. Like,
it's nepotism.
Bart versus Australia comments next up here. So we got Sean Atkinson saying, Sean Atkinson is one of many Aussies who had some corrections for us. So sorry for the huge post, but it's got to be done. I'll clear some things up for you guys. I'll clear up some things from your number one, possibly, Australian fan. Nope, no bidets in Australia here, Hank. Also, no one really says Drongo anymore. One of the most interesting things about Mark Jacko Jackson is that he did a comedy tour with Mark Chopper Reed. Remember the Eric Bands movie Chopper? A convicted contract killer a few years before Chopper died.
Wow.
I used to live in Colorado, so I am very familiar with the horror of the 14 to 21 hour flights. I spent 48 hours in transit to get from Denver to Perth for my sister's wedding, only to have to fly back to Denver after 3 days. Wow. I'm an ecologist, so yeah, the cane toads being introduced has been a massive problem throughout Northern Australia. We weren't the first to introduce a native species with disastrous consequences. In the 1890s, European starlings were released in Central Park. They've displaced many native New Yorker bird species competing for nesting hollows. Cane toads were introduced in Queensland in the 1930s to control sugarcane beetles, which had been a successful program in Jamaica, I think. So, neener, neener, you guys did it first. Okay, I'll stop being the well, actually, guys. Love your show!
There has to be at least one bidet in Australia. I disagree, but yeah, that thing about the invasive species is interesting because I'm not sure if this is apocryphal or made up, but I heard it somewhere that pigeons were brought over to America as the pets of rich people.
Oh.
Like, and if you look at what quote-unquote designer pigeons look like these very attractive show pigeons, they're like these glamorous birds.
Oh, man.
So I imagine some part of that is true.
Wow, I never heard of this.
And I enjoyed the anecdote about Jacko Jackson, who's still alive, and I'm sure still ripped as hell.
Going on a tour with Chopper the Killer.
So Joe Hodgson says, I wish I could sympathize with the notion that Energizer and batteries as a whole are dead. As a father of two small kids, I can say tons of toys still use AA and AAA, and even some of those obnoxious C batteries. I think the last time I bought C batteries before having kids was as a 10-year-old, so I could take my boombox outside. And to make things worse, basically all kids' toys have a battery compartment secured with screws now. Little tiny ones. When your kid is crying his bear stops singing, it's now a process to go find the size 0 screwdriver to replace the damn batteries. I agree with you. Batteries should be abolished. They're horrible for the environment. They're too expensive. And I'm still peeved that the goddamn Xbox One controller needs batteries.
Unbelievable.
I will gladly buy a new controller in 5 years if I don't have to buy a single battery.
Totally,
for any
of
those things.
I was so glad that the PS4 continued the thing. Like, no, it's just charge it. Just plug it in with a USB cord that you have, that every human has now. If you own a PS4, you own a phone with and you own USB batteries.
Yeah, I have to wonder if there's a battery lobby that's paying off these companies. Like, hey, make it take batteries. We'll make it worth your while.
Well, though, my Bluetooth mouse here as well runs on AA batteries. I just had to go buy some for it. So Zach Crabwise says, regarding Henry's comment that he likes hearing what Simpsons meant to people who lived in other countries, having grown up in Canada my whole life, we are inundated with American media. Even our local TV channels would play American shows most of the time, and Simpsons were daily viewing for me once they made syndication as my primary reference point for American culture. It was always fun to see all the cultural similarities we share with America, but most of all the differences. When the Simpsons would satire American culture, I would frequently have to ask my mom to clarify certain issues, the most memorable to me being having to make sure that no one could ever shoot me just for straying on their property, which they technically can, I think. And
that's Castle Doctrine.
I know that that has nothing to do with this episode and not to get political, but it always seemed terrifying to me that that's the reality you exist in. Anyhow, hopefully that doesn't start a flame war, but that's my two Canadian cents.
Every second of our lives in this country is terrifying. But
yeah, you just have to accept, like, well, everyone everyone around me could have a gun.
No eye contact, eyes on the ground, and just go about your business. But yeah, actually, I had a similar experience in that growing up, I would watch a lot of PBS, and I would learn about British people through all the great British sitcoms and shows and like Red Dwarf and things like that. It wasn't until I would have the internet that I could actually look things up and realize what they were like. On Red, so I did not know that the in European countries that speak English, the letter Z is called Zed.
Yeah.
And on Red Dwarf, there was a line. It's like, oh, it's the A to Z of something. They mean they, it wasn't. It was just, well, that wasn't part of the joke. Mm-hmm. The word Zed. But when I was a kid, I was like, oh, that's what they. That's a joke. That's what the Z is in the future, I guess. They call Z Zed, but I had no idea until much later that yes. Z is Zed, and I think Zed just sounds weird. So
for me, it was watching things like Mr. Bean or Danger Mouse, and be like, "Oh, that's what a mailbox looks like, or a phone, or a car, or that that's what the Queen is, or something." Or they have a giant goose.
I couldn't watch more than like 2 minutes of Danger Mouse. I do not understand nostalgia for that show. I'm not saying you're nostalgic for it, but I sense this wave of coming nostalgia for it.
In 1988, anything that was animated, I'd watch it, and it had clever enough writing. It's horrible looking.
It's a radio show with a few drawings thrown in there. So Bradley Winton says, as an Aussie, I feel a duty to write something about this episode, so here I go. Firstly, some corrections / responses to some of the things you guys brought up. No, we don't use bidets in Australia. I think this was just a joke in the line of, isn't it funny that Aussies, who are usually seen as big brutes, use a dainty bidet? On Aussie dollars, we did actually used to use pounds. It was in 1966 we switched to the Aussie dollar. Drongo is Aussie slang that basically is another way of saying someone is an idiot. Cane toads are such a nuisance that you are legally allowed to kill them. I personally love convict jokes. The scene of the people trying to steal Marge and Lisa's camera cracks me up constantly. Foster's tastes like piss and no Aussie drinks it. If an American wants to make fun of Australian beer, it should be VB or Carlton Draft they make fun of. Those are more iconic Aussie beers. They also taste like piss, but at least they are more applicable than Foster's.
And he has a ton more things on Aussie stuff that you guys should just read the whole comment on the page for it on Patreon. Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into the Homer versus Patty and Selma comments now. Anita Rose says, this is one of my all-time favorites. Patty and Selma episodes are always amazing. I love Bart drinking Tab because when this originally aired, I had just become a lifetime Tab drinker. Can you even find Tab anymore?
Get the Tab key and you'll get one.
I'm embarrassed to admit that I'm mad that Maxwell House got rid of the most of the international coffees. Kahlua! Oh, and this there was an episode a while back, the fracking one, where Patty and Selma did try vaping, is what Anita confirms.
That was inevitable, so I'll go back and check that one out, I guess.
I guess it was also inevitable that they were going to have a fracking episode as
you
well.
You know, I haven't heard Patty and Selma talk in like 15 years, and Marge already sounds so old because Julie Kavner is getting old.
Yes.
I really want to know what a modern Patty and Selma sound like. They probably sound like Jacqueline Bouvier. So, Joe Hodgson says, instant coffee is some of the foulest shit ever invented. I agree, Joe. But if you load up your cup with hot water with it, then it kind of tastes like coffee. I only know this because my best friend's parents would keep a jar handy in case of power outages or something. When I'd sleep over in the winter, we'd sleep in the basement where the video games were and the wood stove. We'd heat hot water on the stove and drink instant coffee in some meaningless quest to stay up all night. It could be my memory failing me, but I feel like we always took from the same jar of coffee, so that tells you how often my friend's parents actually drank the stuff. It is disgusting. I can't believe my parents still drink. Well, they don't drink instant coffee. They drink one step above that, which is like Folgers and Maxwell House.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big coffee head. That's why I talk so fast. Henry is not.
No.
But yes, coffee is my best friend.
No, my parents were always Folgers. They'd get the big brick or the big can of grounds and just be in the fridge all the time. They just had the Mr. Coffee machine. Nothing fancier than that.
It's like brown ashes. Once you realize what coffee should look like ground up, it's just like, oh, this is astronaut coffee. Yuck.
I think my mom is just done with coffee. Like she's retired now, as is my dad, so I think they don't need that pep in their step in the morning like before.
I'm like Barney, put it in my veins.
Kiefer Folsom says, this episode holds a special and weird place in my heart. It was one of the first episodes of The Simpsons I ever saw. Crazy thing is, I remember nothing about Homer and Patty and Selma, but I do remember Bart's Ballet B story very clearly. I think this may have been the second episode ever I saw.
Yeah, the A and B stories not matching up reminds me a lot of The Critic in season 4 of The Simpsons, where I'm like, where was the Bart and the Wolf story? Because it has nothing to do with the A story.
Simpsons, I could keep all the B stories together. I knew where they were, but The Critic was just fuzzy enough in my mind that I was like, wait, this is the one where Marty loses weight and the other plot is this? Oh,
I think
okay.
Only after doing the podcast do I have definitive knowledge of which B plots were in which episode. Mm. I assume it'll fall out of my brain next year. So
even more interchangeable on the critic are all the clips of the movie scenes. Yeah. Like, oh, I thought this happened at any other time. I was like, oh, this joke's here. Huh.
So we have A Star Is Burns next, and Jerry says, it really sounds like Nancy Cartwright is trying to speak Japanese with a faux Chinese intonation. I speak Japanese as well and never noticed she was speaking it. Always assumed they were conflating Japanese and Chinese tourists. Yeah, it could have been, I mean, the stereotype is Japanese tourists taking pictures of things, but mm-hmm. maybe Nancy, as a person living in 1995, did not really understand the pronunciation differences between Chinese languages and Japanese languages. So
yeah, I mean, for that generation, like, it's just Asia. It's just yeah. like, it's still a frustrating thing to see when people say, like, well, Asian Americans do this. I was like, that's saying, like, that is basically shoving together, like, dozens of countries yes. into one, like, for your blanket statement. I'd almost say that's racist
could
to make
be.
That. Jacobo Genovese says, as someone who was watching this in Italy in the 1990s, I had no idea that Jay was a character from another show and that this was a crossover episode. I thought that the character was very funny and that it fitted well with the rest of the show. Unsurprisingly, with hindsight, I only recently found out that this was a crossover episode, but that didn't put me off because, and feel free to call me a dork for this, I love crossover episodes. Then you guys taught me that The Critic was created by the same authors as The Simpsons, and therefore I got very interested, watched all the episodes, and listened to fantastic podcast about it. If I can be honest, I don't really like The Critic too much, and I think this episode of The Simpsons might be the best episode featuring J.A. Sherman across two shows.
So this person is from Italy in the 90s. I want to know if Ghost Chasers 2 was really localized as your mother has a hairy back. That's a Critic joke.
Yeah, that's terrible localization.
Yes. Yeah, I think, I don't know, my thoughts on The Critic have changed. I can see all the flaws now, and really after doing the series, we're almost done. I feel like, man, if this show had a third season, I think it could be so much better.
I think they would have finally figured it out in the third season.
You could see them, like, by the end of season two, they are making these really great episodes. They're figuring out, you know, what character should be. I believe Jeremy would just disappear in season three.
Yeah. They're finding out how wacky they can be. Like, All the Duke's Men is such an insane episode, as is them being stuck on an island. Frankie. So it's. I think they were finally figuring it out. I also think they'd have maybe hopefully lost the last of their shame. They'd stop having Jay just apologize at the end of episodes. Like, this should have been better. I'm sorry.
I hate seeing that. So David Thomason says, I had a similar experience as Jacopo, I'm sorry if I get your name wrong, in that I had no idea Jay was from another television show and just assumed the crossover jokes were because he was on a show within The Simpsons and The Simpsons as a show was becoming more meta and self-aware in itself being a show. Watching it now after watching The Critic, the main thing to get over is Jay being yellow. Unlike Jacopo, I'm not from sunny Italy but rainy Scotland. Doing some research, it seems The Critic was shown in the UK, but I couldn't find the exact broadcast history of it. I did ask if anyone knew about the broadcast history of The Critic in the UK in a community post. Maybe you could ask the question on an episode of Talk to the Audience. As this is a podcast, it's got more listeners than commenters. I have to ask one question for David. What do you think about Groundskeeper Willie?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to hear that.
I would like to know what you think of him and his Glaswegian accent, perhaps.
And David, every Scottish person videotapes people in their cars. Do you do that? I trust The Simpsons.
But yes, any listeners out there who remember when The Critic aired in the UK, that would be helpful information as well. Maybe put that in the comments for this week's episode. All right, Tashlin says, just thought this was worth bringing up. This is the second show on the larger Laser Time Network that I've heard you guys mention John Lovett's attractive young girlfriend. If you're talking about the young woman Jessica Lowndes, this was a hoax from a year ago. It was an early April Fool's joke to promote a music video.
Wow, I'm single.
Yuck.
Way to go, John Lovitz. So up next, we have some talking critic comments. This one is from Jay and Alice and Siskel and Ebert. And Jerry says, Three Ninjas Knuckle Up was actually directed by renowned Korean director Shin Sang-ok. He was a pioneering South Korean director in the 60s, but is most famous in the West for being kidnapped by Kim Jong-il and being forced to direct propaganda films for decades, most famously the Godzilla ripoff Pulsagari, which actually had some help from the Godzilla production team. He eventually escaped to the U.S. and made movies like Three Ninjas. Wow. After being kidnapped in North Korea, making Three Ninjas must have been like heaven.
Yeah, I know. After spending 30 years held captive by Kim Jong-il, then they'd be like, look, you children, kick this guy.
I welcome the child kicks.
Joseph Story says, when I was a kid, I thought Siskel and Ebert's word was law when it came to movies. If I saw them give a movie two thumbs up, that it was definitely a great film. Honestly, I'm not sure why I came to this conclusion. It's kind of weird when I think about it. As I got older, I would read Roger Ebert's reviews in the Chicago Sun-Times and held on to the belief that his picks were winners.
I would usually go by the recommendations, although I love when they disagreed. Mm-hmm. And one thing I didn't bring up on the podcast was I love how thumbs up and thumbs down were it was a binary system. Like, it was either we like it or we don't. But I also loved how they would cheat it. They'd be like, two thumbs up, way up. Or like a triumphant thumbs up. They would add like these qualifiers to the amount of thumb uppiness it was. I always loved that, how they cheated that.
But as long as you got two thumbs up, you could put in your ads. Like, then that was all the money they needed. That you could print money for your movie at that point, pretty much.
So Joe Hodgson is back, and he says, critics were rarely included in the Academy Awards celebration. Gene Siskel was left out in the In Memoriam video package, and I remember that upsetting some. Whoopi Goldberg, after the video, slipped in a quick tribute, which was sweet of her. By the time Ebert passed away, they had softened their draconian stance on the whole thing and stuck him in the video package. That's good to hear. I'm sad that Siskel got slighted like that.
Yeah, that's pretty crappy of them to do back in 99. I think for Ebert, though, even if they were still being jerks of, like, no critics, like, he did write a film. Like, he is a screenwriter.
And Siskel, I think, had the misfortune of dying really fast after they found his cancer. Yeah. Like, Ebert, I think, was around for maybe a decade after his cancer scare.
I think so, too. I think it was right after... I can't even watch Brown Bunny because I just associate it with Vince Gallo wishing cancer upon Roger Ebert and then Roger Ebert getting it. And, like... I was like, fuck you, Vincent Gallo.
He got some good revenge against Rob Schneider, though.
That is true. Yeah. Yes, yeah. All right, now on to the Lisa's Wedding comments. Jenny H. says, Mandy Patinkin was also on a show called Dead Like Me. He gets to show off his voice by singing Always by Irving Berlin in a very beautiful scene that Yeardley Smith also cameos on the show. Mandy Patinkin has also said that in the iconic Inigo Montoya fight scene with a six-fingered man, he has in his mind getting avenging his own father who had died of cancer. He talks about it in the documentary for the film.
I really do have Mandy Patinkin's voice in my head after doing Lisa's Wedding. In fact, we were at a post-Retronauts dinner and something, I forget, unfortunate happened or something, I don't know, mediocre happened. I was like, that's not so bad.
That's not so bad.
So I love that performance so much, even more after doing this episode. So Chris J. Kappel says, this is a very special episode for me, not just being the British angle, me being a Brit, but it also coincided with my first visit to the U.S. Disney World, yay! And became the first ever episode of The Simpsons I actually saw the same time as the U.S.
Nice.
BBC had the show over here, and because they got it late, it was running at least 2 years behind the U.S. ridiculously.
Man, I can't imagine to be... If I had the same level of Simpsons fandom, except I was 2 years behind America and watching the episodes as soon as they came to my country, and then knowing that in another country they had 2 more years of Simpsons that I could be watching, it would drive me nuts.
I was similarly driven nuts by being a video game fan in the 90s. There's like three Final Fantasies I can't play. This game came out a year ago. It's just coming over here now. I sounded like that in the 90s, by the way.
Or as an anime fan, I was like, I'll never see End of Evangelion. I just never will. It's never coming here.
Got to get that BCD.
I eventually did. Oh, yes. My turn. Yeah. The Terrible Secret of Space says, I like to use the occasion of my favorite episode, The Simpsons, to thank Talking Simpsons for putting out such a great podcast so consistently and for being part of my own wedding story, however small.
Wow.
My wife and I had a destination wedding in Scotland last year, and listening to the fantastic Homer at the Bat episode really went a long way in towards settling my nerves in the time between getting ready and then traveling across town to meet up with friends and family at the venue for the ceremony. Fortunately, we chose the no-nonsense salad foundation of the government registrar's office as a venue instead of the cheap showiness of nature. So I assume because of that, the ceremony went off without a problem, and my wife and I continue to remain married to this day.
I have to say, I believe The Terrible Secret of Space is a Something Awful reference from like 17 years ago. So congratulations, really? Wow. One Something Awful fan had sex. I'm still hoping
finally
for it. But that's great. Yeah, and actually I'm just realizing that in the same year they did an Australian episode and an episode sort of about the UK.
Mm-hmm.
In a way
they do take, I mean, it was their first trip to England, just the 2010 future England, for about 2 minutes, and
yeah.
Just told Uncle Edwin.
So we have a message from Tom, another Brit. I agree. He says, I agree that the Hugh accent is good, but occasionally a little off. When Americans get praised for doing a good British accent, Renee Zellweger in Bridget Jones is a good example. It sounds passable to British ears, but a little overwrought. A bit too clipped in Mary Poppins in a way that the vast minority of Brits never actually spoke. The bit where he says, I'd be delighted, at dinner, is especially over the top, and it really sounds like someone doing an accent. A couple of things that are incongruous about this episode, though. Marge is wrong. Mainland Europe uses kilometers, while Britain still uses miles. Britain uses a weird mix of metric and imperial. The way Hugh cries when Homer desecrates the Union Jack is written from such an American kind of perspective and cultural attitude. In my experience, Brits on the whole have nowhere near the same level of reverence for our flag as Americans do the Stars and Stripes. I mean, we don't yet. Maybe we will one day, in a sort of sad, nostalgic way, after Brexit has ultimately destroyed the United Kingdom.
Ooh.
So I have a few things to say. This was not intentional by the writers. He was crying over the flag because he was remembering the horrors of World War III.
Yes.
And what happened, and the bloodshed and the carnage.
That gave the entire British population new appreciation for their flag and a new patriotism.
But I'm glad that Manny Patinkin had a good British accent. I can always tell when a Brit is doing an American accent. Going back to Red Dwarf, I remember Crichton the robot was a British actor doing an American accent. Red Dwarf is my only UK thing I know, by the way. And he would say the word condom.
Condom.
Yeah, it was like, that's not, oh, I know you're British. I can tell. You've got that square head.
Yeah. I also think of Benedict Cumberbatch's accent. He's just like, yes, I'm American. Me, Benedict Cumberbatch. It's, though I've also heard Brits get into the American accent, like their entryway is like, sure, dude.
Yeah,
like it's
the California kind
of, yeah, like the California 80s accent, though, like, or the surfer accent. And that, though, that's also not fair either. Not like to say, well, what's your American accent? Well, like, you have like 80 American accents you could take from. The same with British accents, like he said that he does so well, as Hugh is a very posh accent.
Yeah, I believe someone pointed out it's RP, which I was a linguistics minor. I pay a lot of money every month for my student loan, so I can bring up on this show that RP is received pronunciation. It means no one actually talks like that. That's how they teach broadcasters to speak, like, to sound distinguished and so everyone can understand them. So there's, like, a uniform dialect with no, like, regional differences in their speech patterns. But, yeah.
And I do wonder how other countries treat the flag and their belief. Because, yeah, I think it's crazy now still that people are just like, you burned the flag. Like,
yeah.
In America, flag burning is not illegal, but it is seen as so wrong that people think it is illegal. Like, I had to have a conversation with, like, a younger woman who started at the job a while back I worked at, and we were talking about things like, and yeah, you can't even burn the flag. I was like, no, you can. There's been multiple, like, lawsuits about this. You can burn the flag. You Republicans don't want you to burn a flag.
And they're constantly Democrats trying to roll that back.
Yeah,
like,
every time. Yeah. Like, no, it's a free speech thing, which I fucking love that. Let me get a little bit on a soapbox here. That, like, the assholes who say, like, I'm a free speech warrior, I think we should listen to every Nazi. Those fuckers, if you tell them, like, okay, then I'm going to burn a flag right in front of you, they would cry those tears and be like, fuck you, you hate America. Like, that proves they don't give a fuck about free speech, those guys.
Yeah,
like,
same with kneeling, not even saying anything. Just like, that, there are soldiers that are crying.
Don't you know these soldiers? I never went to war myself, but these soldiers are sad because of you. Fuck you. Like, those soldiers didn't get shot so you could use them in an argument. Like, fuck you.
We're ending on a positive note.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. You know how we feel. You're our patrons. We're left-wing wackos, but you love us. We're lovable wackos. So, yeah, thanks for listening. I want to say there might be a Christmas-based surprise this month. I'm going to try to put something together with Henry, and I don't know if it's going to happen, but I really want it to. So keep watching that Patreon. You might be able to vote on something, and, of course, what we'll be doing after Talking Critic, too.
Yes, yeah, and some interviews are coming up, too, so keep watching the skies.
Yeah,
I mean skies.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so keep watching the skies and the skies, and we'll see you later this month for another Talk to the Audience. See you then.
Wow. Infotainment.